Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Wines of Bordeaux. Visit their website at bordeaux.com.
I am Patrick Martins, host of The Main Course. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Folks, welcome back. It's Food Talk. We're back. We had a 2 week spring break. Isn't that nice to have a radio station to take spring break as if we're still in college? I like that. You need a spring break, right? Did we take a winter break this year? I don't remember. But yeah, we did. We take a break between Christmas and over Christmas and New Year's. So it's great. It's like, yeah, gotta like it. That's what modern radio does. Anyway, I want to give a shout out. We've been filming every week. We're filming new shows for next season's PBS, and we had filmed a great one yesterday with Duki Hong, who's a chef in New York City in K-Town. Has a great, he's a young 25, 26 year old kid. He's great. He just wrote a book, co-authored a book, I should say, with Matt Rodbard called Koreatown, where the two of them spent a couple of years traveling all around America, exploring Koreatown's USA, and beyond the usual LA, New York, San Francisco, you know, big markets, into little markets, Duluth, Georgia, who knew? And then they did these great recipes so you can do Korean food at home, often simpler than you think. And that research was done in Dookie's kitchen with his electric stove on 38th Street in Manhattan, where we ended up filming some of the segments too. If you haven't seen the book Koreatown, it's great. It's a great story about Korean food in America. And a ton of recipes that are simple and work and are vetted by a chef, which is a really rare thing these days, in my opinion, in the book world. So congratulations to those guys. It was great. Next week we'll be with Wilson Tang at Nam Wa Tea Parlor. That should be fun. America's first dim sum restaurant going back to like the 20s. So good stuff happening on film and good stuff back happening on the radio. Today's show, I'll have to like have a disclaimer before with the show. If you're a recovering alcoholic and you don't want to be tempted back to the dark side, don't listen to this show today, because we cover food and wine a lot in this show. I mean, that's pretty much what this show is. We have psalms on, we have winemakers on, we have producers on, we have chefs on all the time. We don't do a whole lot in the cocktail realm, but really the whole show today, the whole hour is going to be devoted to just that particular subject, with two really interesting books that pretty much just landed. The first one, and my first guest in a minute, will be Jules Aaron. The name of her book is Zen and Tonic, Savory and Fresh Cocktails for the Enlightened Drinker. But it's really an interesting twist on the whole cocktail culture thing, because there's like a health angle to it. So I don't know. I mean, there's a little, like, if you read her description, it says Jules Aaron is a New York City-based mixologist, beverage consultant, and natural lifestyle expert, which kind of seems like an oxymoron in a sentence, okay? But I'm just saying that. But apparently it's true. You can be all of those things in one sentence, and she's the embodiment of that. So we'll talk about her book, which is really this kind of boring down deep into how to do really super delicious, healthy, cage-free, organic cocktails. And there's just it's funny, because every time I pick up one of these books and I flip through it, I'm like, damn, when you think about it, she's got a point. And then my second guest is a guy who was apparently named appropriately. His name is Mark Bitterman. And he has a great new book out called Field Guide to Bitters and Amari. And I guess if you're listening to the show, you know what those are. You know, bitters are those little tinctures that we have been seeing exploding lately in the realm of cocktails and mixology, as everyone seems to be producing yet another artisanal bitter and Amari, that whole class of Italian bitters that I kind of grew up drinking because my last name's Colomeco, and Italians just seem to never get enough of their bitter after dinner concoctions made from God knows what. So that's the whole show. It's going to be about cocktail mixology with Jules, and then we're going to talk about the history of bitters and Amari, how to make them at home. And both these books are astonishing too, in terms of like the front end of both of these books is how to make stuff at home. In terms of tinctures and syrups and bitters and all that sort of extractions, and then use them in the realm of making cocktails, and in the case of Mark's book, even incorporating them into the savory side of the dinner table. So let's just, without any further ado, introduce Jules. Jules, hi. Sorry for taking up 5 minutes of your time with the intro, but how are you?
That's quite all right. I'm good. How are you, Mike?
Good, good, good. So you're New York-based, but you're not out of town today. Is that what's going on?
That is correct. Honestly, I haven't worked in New York in a while, because once I started this book project, I kind of moved out of New York City, per se, and moved to my cabin upstate New York, where it was a little bit of a better working environment in terms of book writing.
Yeah, a friend of mine is trying to write one of her another novel, and she's disconnected her internet, her television. She lives in Brooklyn, but it's like, you know, she just can't get it done. Like, so they have no Wi-Fi, they have no internet, they have no television.
That's exactly how my cabin is.
Right, so it's kind of like what she did is she turned her floor through apartment in Park Slope into a cabin, basically. Although I guess she can she sneaks out once in a while with her laptop and goes somewhere with a Wi-Fi hotspot and responds to everyone's emails and stuff. So, yes. Yeah, so tell me about, just if I can, just before we get to the book, and again, the name of the book is Zen mm-hmm. and Tonic. What got you, and I'm sure there's a million reasons, but, you know, you're... I'm not going to guess your age because people hate it when you do that. But there's this resurgence in cocktail culture that I've been here since 1982, and you know there was just like standard stuff for like my whole lifetime here. And then who knows where it started and who knows how. I mean, there was Milk and Honey and there was these places, but like sometime in this millennium, cocktails just blew up, like the whole thing around it. I mean, Dale DeGroff's been on this thing forever. He's like the godfather. But what drew you into the cocktail realm?
I put myself through school bartending. You know, it was as simple as that. You know, I actually, I have a master's in publishing from NYU. So that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to work in magazine publishing, actually. And I did for a couple of years. And I had a pretty disillusioned experience, a little bit like Devil Wears Prada, but without the happy ending. And so I ended up going back to bartending. And, you know, it just always seemed to go back to bartending. And the book really is really a personal experience for me, because for a really, really long time, I never really cared for the simple syrups and the sour mixes that were involved in cocktail making. They gave me headaches, they gave me hangovers, and I just couldn't stand it. And so I started by modifying my own drinks, really. And then as like you said, somewhere in this millennium, like things started blowing up in the cocktail world. And I think it has to do with how the food culture developed, and there was such a revolution in clean eating. And I think that's what kind of drove me to make that connection. I mean, I was always a healthy person. I grew up in a household. My mom was a sous chef, so I grew up with, you know, loving food,
right.
Eating a lot of good food.
Right.
But it was always real food.
Right.
It was never canned. It was never boxed. So, you know, I have that real food experience, and I don't like to substitute that for, you know, quick fixes. And so in that sense, you know, I was always looking to streamline, clean out, you know, the ingredients that weren't necessary in cocktails, And so, yeah. And then, you know, I was really into fitness as well. So,
which is funny. I can interrupt you for 1 second.
Eating.
Right. I read this about you. So your dad used to make you these tonics too. That was like kind of another backstory, right? You grew up drinking these concoctions that your dad made. Was that part?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. My dad, my goodness. He had like this whole cycle for me. Eight week cycle where every week I would drink a different herbal tonic, that he would make. Yeah. They were like stinging nettle and sage.
But where did he get that from?
Valerian.
Where did you grow up that you were doing that? I'm just curious.
Montreal. I grew up in Montreal.
And where did your dad pick that tradition up? Because that's kind of an outlier. I mean, that's kind of fringe.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I'm not sure where he picked that up, but he was always into that. I mean, he was a bartender and a restaurateur for years as well, but he was always into like that natural herbal stuff. So can't really tell you where he picked it up, but he was so into that stuff. And yeah, you know, he was just always trying to boost my immunity and just wanted me to grow up nice and strong.
God, my parents are great. I mean, you had two great parents. You were eating real food, and your dad was making, like, these really cool kind of holistic tonics for you. That's great. I mean, and this was really at a time, I think, I guess I'm going back to the, you know, 80s or 90s when that was really kind of behavior that was, you know, an outlier. That wasn't what was going on in the neighborhood in most households.
Right. Right, exactly.
But it does explain where you got to where you are, and also you know, majoring in publishing at NYU, that's great. So let's drop $200,000 into something that like an industry that's shrinking every 5 minutes, right? and then you make money at bartending, so now it all makes sense. But the funny thing for me, so the fitness side too. I mean, it's funny. For me, it's like a dichotomy. I work out 7 days a week. I've always worked out 7 days a week. I've got black belts. I used to box. I've run 5 marathons. I swam around Key West. We came in second place in a relay a couple of years ago. And I drink, and that always seemed like a complete disconnect. Like my friends that are really healthy, like the guys I swam around Key West with, the guys I work out with for the most part, are mostly like teetotaling, non-smoking, rail thin, up at 5 a.m. A-type personalities. And, you know, I'm an ex-chef, which means, you know, they want to work out with me at 8 a.m. I'm like, guys, I don't wake up at 8 a.m. Like, we can work out at the crack of 11. Okay, that's early for me. I'm still on chef's hour. So it's funny. How did like the fitness thing and the mixology thing? What's the intersection there?
Well, you know, I mean, it's been a long time coming, but I mean, I know you practice karate, so did I, and so when I was testing for my black belt, I was lucky enough to be working at a bar that allowed me to leave during happy hour to go and
to the dojo,
leave my black belt from my master, and that was the only time that he would do this. And so, you know, it's just, but since then, you know, I've also studied holistic health. I have a certification in health coaching, holistic health coaching. I've also studied Chinese medicine. And so, yeah, I've always had like this, yeah, a very opposite kind of perspective. But it always, yeah, like you were saying, you know, your friends, they were all, you know, the health fitness types, you know, they were so clean in their eating habits, right? But, you know, and it just bothered me because I was in that world too. It just bothered me that they were just eating chicken and broccoli every night.
Yes.
That just wasn't a way to live.
Like steamed skinless chicken.
sense, you know, if they were drinking, it would be vodka soda because that would be the low-cal option. And so that just, like, there's more to life than that, you know? And as a foodie, I needed to, like, help people just experience more out of it, so.
Well, you do. I mean, this book is really this kind of a, I mean, it's the last thing I needed to see because now it's just going to encourage more of my debauchery, but I can use it as a defense later on. So it starts out, just so people can get the breakdown. The name of the book is Zen and Tonic. My guest is Jules Aaron, who is, as I mentioned, in one sentence, apparently several contradictory. She's a New York-based mixologist. Just beverage consultant and natural lifestyle expert, go figure. But she is. She just explained. So now that we got past that, so it's broken down into a bunch of sections. The fundamentals, which is kind of big, and which is a chunk of this book, and I kind of want to dwell there for a while. And then after that, Cocktails by description, like lush and fruity, fresh and crisp, garden fresh, floral and fragrant, sweet. And the recipes are astonishing. I mean, some of these recipes, I'm just reading thinking, wow, if I had all those ingredients, I'd want one of those like right now. But talk about, in the essential thing, okay, we don't need to talk about bar tools as much. So you have like, you know, the muddler, the jiggler, the shaker, the strainer, ice tray, you know, ice. Ice is a whole, we could do 20 minutes on ice, I suppose, if we wanted to. Essential glassware. If I could just ask you this, why the champagne flute for cocktails?
The champagne, well, you know, I mean, there's definitely, I have at least a few drinks in here where you're muddling some fresh berries and herbs into, you know, instead of doing the standard mimosa type drink where you're just pouring, you know, a bottled orange juice on top of your champagne, you know, you just muddle a few berries with some herb like sage, for instance, and then you have some champagne over it.
So got you. Okay. Fresh. All right. Yeah. It's one of the few glasswares that I sort of like. I love champagne. I'm a complete wine nut, and I always tell people drink champagne out of a white wine glass because I just hate champagne flutes because of the shape. But anyway, the nothing to do. The cocktails look good, and then they're kind of sexy. They're long stemmed. They're thin, and they'll keep the bubbles intact for a while in something where you've added bubbles. But you had this. I mean, I love how this thing begins with the choices of alcohol, which is something, honestly, I felt like really stupid, like it never occurred to me in this world when, like, you know, if you're in the food space or the beverage space or the wine space, the whole, like, GMO, non-interventionist, back-to-roots thing is so core to what we're all about these days. And then I thought, like, I met somebody at a great wine bar in New York called Ten Bells. It's a natural wine bar on Broome Street. And mm-hmm. There was a big party there last week. There was a Jura producer, and all of my Somme friends were there. And there were a couple of women there, and one of them wrote a big book on whiskey and mixology. And her first question to me, like just to see if I knew what I was talking about, was, you know, what's the biggest producer? Like the biggest producer of vodka in the world is Smirnoff, and it's supposed to be a Russian vodka. And then she said, like, where's it made? And I said, anywhere they want to make it. She said, what's it made from? I said, the cheapest shit they can make it out of. You know, it doesn't matter. Smirnoff can make it. It's a distilled grain alcohol, but it can be made from molasses. There are no rules. It's yeah. Double distilled, triple. It's flavorless, odorless, colorless. It's junk. And then, so you're actually saying, okay, that part's true. But here are vodkas that are good. Here are tequilas that are good. Here are mezcals, which is really some interesting stuff.
Right. Yeah. Because I mean, if you're going to pay so much attention to what you eat,
right.
Why wouldn't you do the same?
Correct.
About with your spirits.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that's just like this neat thing, and then you identify like brands. Like I had no idea. I'm not a vodka guy, but you know, Square One people can buy, Rain Organics, Prairie Organic. I do drink tequila, and I'm glad you mentioned Casa Noble. It's a great tequila. It's really good. I thank Eric Asimov of the New York Times. That's how I heard about it. So you go through like all the basic spirits and some winemakers that are natural and that are clean, and then you kind of get into the drinks with benefits. Talk a little bit about this. Like when did you start to incorporate, how do you pronounce that? Acai? I know what those things are. I have them in my cabinet.
Acai.
See, I always fuck it up. Sorry. But those little tiny little berries that when you soak them a little bit, they almost get like tapioca kind of starch thing going on. You got this whole bunch of like healthy things to incorporate too. And I guess that just comes from your health end.
Right, exactly. You know, I mean, these are all little things that I picked up along the way studying Ayurvedic sciences and Chinese medicine and just like the holistic side of things. And it's just really easy, you know, if you buy these things that are not hard to find these days,
right.
You know, if you've got like a natural food store nearby or, you know, I have a whole resource in the back of the book where you can buy things online as well. And if you've got these things in your house, you know, it's very easy to just drop some, let's say, chia seeds into your drink, and you've got yourself a little boost of protein and, you know, and it's that simple.
It is. And then the ice cube thing's so cool. Like, you have these pictures, and it's great. Like, I feel terrible because my ice cubes are just made from, like, New York tap water. Why aren't I putting, like, edible flour ice cubes in my refrigerator? Or cherry and noni juice ice cubes? Or how about this? Almond milk and vanilla ice cubes. That just sounds great.
That's awesome because you can just drop one of those in your ice latte or your ice coffee in the morning. You know, it's as simple as that.
Yeah, you got pictures of ice cubes with stems of rosemary in them and serrano peppers. It's so cool. Then you have a whole section on garnishes, which is really, really great. And then this thing of syrup. So And you're giving recipes for how to make these syrups. So these are just this, so you hold up at your cabin upstate and just playing around with these recipes?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I had like this whole moment where I was like, that's it. I quit bartending. You know, I moved upstate and, you know, I was sitting in this cabin and that's where I had like that first epiphany for the book. And yeah, I just started playing around with flavor combinations and just, yeah, experimenting with that.
All right. So I live on the Lower East Side and I don't go into the bars too frequently, but you know, there's bars all over me that don't close till 4 a.m. and the kids rumble out drunk and vomiting at 4:30 and crying into their cell phones and falling over. And shots are a big part of like bar culture for young kids. And then I look at this picture. It's like an aerial shot straight down on obviously what is 6 shot glasses, but yours are the beetberry bomb. Talk about this because these things sound great. I mean, so the ingredient is, I'll read the ingredient list. This is crazy. This does not sound like it. Until the end, it sounds like something, yeah, that you'd make it with a health food recipe. The ingredients are 4 beets, 2 apples, a cup of frozen raspberries, and, drumroll, 4 ounces of gin. And that's it. Boom. In a processor, bang, filtered, and then drink it, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's that simple. It's just a nice way to, you know, if you're just before going out, you know, if you want to do a shot with your friends, it's a great way to just liven things up. And the beet, you know, it's got so many health benefits that, you know, it's just nice to have these healthy ingredients in your drink, you know.
The rejuvenator. I'm loving this. This is like you're just encouraging those of us that don't need encouragement. So the rejuvenators, it's served in like the picture of it. These remind me of like my grandmother's wine glasses. I don't know where you got those glasses for this shot, but I grew up with stuff like that. They're really hard to drink from, but they're cute. Like etched glass in this ridiculous shape. The kind of stuff no one drinks out of anymore, except if you have a cool cocktail bar. But again, these ingredients. So a tablespoon of bee pollen granules. Check, healthy so far. 3 ounces of pomegranate juice. I'm in. That sounds great. And then, yes, 4 ounces of whiskey.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't get more simple than that, you know? And it just makes you feel good. This, you know, like a drink like that will actually make you feel really good. And that was the point of the book. Keep it easy, simple, and delicious.
And they keep going on. One of the ones that caught my eye was the drunken avocado. Now, how did you even get to the place where you made this drink? Because I just don't think of avocados as in the world of beverage. So tell me about that. I guess because you were looking at healthy. I mean, I can kind of okay. You're casting a net, and they're considered healthy fats. They're good for you. But talk about that drink, would you?
Well, I mean, for me, like when I think of tequila, I think of, you know, guacamole. I think of spice, you know. And so, like, what are the combinations that go so well with, you know, with guacamole and salsa and, you know, when you're dipping your tortilla chip in all of this, you know, and you're having a margarita. So why not pair all of that together and have a drink that basically embodies this whole concept.
Yeah, it's like this healthy green margarita. And then, again, these ingredients, they're so simple. 2 tablespoons of, I guess, diced, small, diced, whatever, avocado in one form or another. A teaspoon of fresh grated ginger. That's good. Half a cup of cubed pineapple, plus some more big chunks for garnish. 3 lime wedges, some fresh cilantro sprigs, and then 2 ounces of tequila. And you're muddling the avocado, ginger, pineapple, lime, cilantro. Fill with ice, add the tequila, shake well, double strain, and garnish with pineapple cubes. I mean, that just sounds like something you can get plastered on.
It's delicious.
I know, that's the problem. It has tequila in it.
It does have tequila in it, yes. But, you know, you can make it without tequila.
Yeah, but then it's a smoothie. You know, what I love about this stuff is, like, everything in the book sounds like the kind of stuff I drink in the summer all day long before dinner. And then you're adding the stuff that I drink before dinner, but right before dinner or with dinner or after dinner. So it's like super, super healthy. And then here's the booze. And it's kind of like sneaking in the sucker punch. Well, it's a great book. Congratulations. I mean, I have to tell you, I don't do a lot of beverage stuff on the shows. Most of the times I get these books in the mail and they go straight to the Strand, where I just say, keep them, give them, you know. I don't, there's just so much bad stuff out there. But, I mean, this is really, how many recipes are in this? Do you know? You wrote the damn thing.
100.
I should have counted. So it's like a primer on the correct boozes to buy, from clear to brown to rum to tequila. Some really good brands and some hints on sourcing. And then what you're going to need to make the cocktails in terms of like the basic equipment. Once you have that investment, you don't really need to buy that stuff anymore. Some options for glassware, which make a lot of sense. How to make syrups, how to make extractions. And then these recipes that are just great, great, great. Congratulations on the book. My liver is probably saying no thank you. But they really actually sound like you could rationalize your way of saying, this is a really hell. I mean, you're not going to drink 20 of these or 5 of these, but if you have one or two of these, they actually sound like they're great for you.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, because they're so nutrient dense, you're not going to want to have too many either. So, yeah, it's a good way to, you know, get some good stuff in you and enjoy yourself.
Well, good. So now that you're done with the book, are you touring on it? Are you doing anything? Are you having fun? Are you going back to the dojo?
I'm actually in the process of writing a second book, nothing to do with cocktails, but actually has to do with vegan cheese. So that's what I'm working on right now.
You are finding niches to write about, aren't you? And what's, if you don't mind me asking, what style karate did you study?
What's that?
What style karate?
Kyokushin Kai.
You study Kyokushin? Where?
Actually, I studied in Oyama, the Oyama Studios in Midtown on 34th Street.
Who was your instructor? Elizabeth Powell Garai's husband? Yeah, I know those guys. He studied with me because Kyokushin is my black belt. So I got that back in 84, and then it became Oyama Karate because Shihan...
Exactly.
And it split off, and our dojo was on West 4th Street above the Lamsons. It was a really tough school. I mean, it was like the black belt only night. Guys were getting dragged out with broken everything, and the black belt test was brutal. And then I know who your instructor is because he was actually a contemporary of mine in the 80s. He opened up a dojo that's like on the second or third floor off of Fifth Avenue, right in Midtown.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. Was it Michelle?
Yeah, I don't. It's a husband-wife team. I just remember that because I see them still on Facebook. But that's a great style. That's a tough style, kid. Congratulations.
It is. It's a very tough style. I had 15 fights to do for my black belt.
Your black belt test is brutal. It's not just 15 fights, but it's 15 fights against other black belts that they bring in from out of state as to beat up fresh meat. And
yes.
You know, for the first 4 or 5, you're kind of on point. And then those low kicks and all the stuff start to get to you. And like by the last 5, you're just going, okay, this is for my black belt. This is for my deal. Let's go, kid. Come on, there's no dog in it. I will tell you, I mean, I shouldn't say this on the radio because it sounds gross, but this is how tough it was. I was actually so cocky, I biked to my black belt test on a bicycle, and I biked home, and my legs were, like, so swollen. When I got home, I peed blood for about 5 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
Kyokushin days. Congratulations. As they say in the dojo, us.
Us.
It's a great book. My guest has been Jules Aaron, so... There she goes. She walks the walk and talks the talk. She's got a black belt and a great style of karate. She makes some badass drinks, and now she's going to write a book about vegan cheese. I love it. All right. Keep up the great work. Look for when that book comes out. Send me a copy. We'll get you on the radio again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you. Thank you. Okay, my next guest, stay tuned. I'll take a quick spot, but I've got a great guy coming on. His name is, appropriately, Mark Bitterman. His book is The Field Guide to Bitters and Amari. Quick break, and we'll be back with Mark in the studio. Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home? that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavitas living in Rome, Colavitas living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. So when you think of the great wine regions of the world historically, I mean, you're going to be led back to Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, okay, maybe Piedmont, Italy, too. And as a chef growing up, boy, if you were working in great restaurants in the 70s and 80s, they were mostly all French, and we grew up drinking Bordeaux and Burgundy and Champagne with impunity. Well, fast forward to today, and I just got back from the 2015 Bordeaux harvest. We were there for a week with a bunch of sommeliers. It was so much fun, and I'll tell you, this isn't your grandfather's Bordeaux. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons working with this great terroir that they've lived on, the soil that they know that they've grown up with, and the great varietals that we all know and love, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec. You know, this style of Bordeaux now that's younger, that's fresher, that's meant to be consumed now and not cellared, because honestly, which of us has a cellar? And who wants to buy a bottle of wine and wait 10 years? So the Bordeaux whites are amazing. Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, like, hello, two grapes that we know. The reds tell all sorts of different stories, from the left bank style that are a little more Cabernet Sauvignon driven, a little more structured, right bank a little more Merlot, a little easier, a little more upfront friendly. But if you haven't thought about drinking Bordeaux wine, give it another shot. For $15 to $35 in that price range, which is my price range, there's tremendous value in there. So if you're walking past a Bordeaux aisle, stop, grab a great bottle. These are some of the most food-friendly wines on planet Earth. Hey, folks, welcome back. Michael Michael here. Food Talks, the show, segment two for this particular day. And as I said in the interest of full disclosure, if you're not into booze or mixology, this is not the show for you. But I am, so it's for me. In any case, Mark Bitterman, we've never met before, man. Welcome to Food Talk. Great to have you in here.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, great name. I mean, wow. What got you into, like, the bitters thing? What lured you into this world?
Yeah, I like to kid around that it was genetics.
I was going to say that, but I figured everyone else did.
Yeah. I'm not so sure, because I did start early. I was goofing around with cocktails when I was a kid and obviously not drinking them, but I think I was such a bad baker that it was the one thing I could turn to. It was my solace. And then by high school, I was kind of collecting wine. And was, again, not a really big drinker, but I love the flavor and the stories in wine. And
by high school?
Yeah, I had a wine cellar
in
high school.
This whole millennial thing. Like I was in – so you're from New York?
I was born in New York.
Okay. Well, anyway, so like my world's wine guys and food guys and restaurant guys and chefs. That's all I do. And you know, in the wine space, like, there's like this new breed of sommeliers that are like everywhere now. They're like 25 years old, yeah. And they're freaking absolute geniuses. And I keep meeting them. Like, I was in Bordeaux with Patrick Capiello. We're staying at the same hotel. Patrick's got Pearl and Ash and Rebel. Of course, Patrick's almost 40, which I guess almost makes him God knows what.
Almost not a millennial anymore.
But he brought with him like 8 soms that he'd selected from Las Vegas, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, a few from New York. And the oldest one was like 32, and the average age was like the mid 20s. I'm like, how the F do you know this much about wine? But you're in that wheel. So you guys just sort of started young. You were smart. And instead of going out and doing Jaeger shots, you were drinking, like, you were actually developing a palate.
Yeah, between Jaeger shots.
Okay, be honest. So you got the wine? What, because it was a beverage at home at the table?
Yeah, it was a beverage at home. It was Santa Barbara, California is where I grew up. And it was one of those things that, like, I liked the novelty of it almost as a kid. It was like, there's this beautiful stuff. You could buy a bottle for like $10 and you could put it away and bring it out, you know, 2 years later. And I just kind of collected it sort of out of dorky geek stamp collecting kind of interest, I think, as much. I never had really the encyclopedic knowledge that a good sommelier will have.
Right, that you need to pass the exams. I'm not sure you need that to enjoy it at all. In fact, I'm sure that you don't, because I don't have it, but it does not stop me from loving it and putting my nose in every glass and admiring how they change and now becoming like a big natural wine drinker. So, but bitters, this is a funny thing. So I grew up, I'm Italian, so I grew up like in West Philly, Italian-American neighborhood. And, you know, my grandparents and my mom, she was a great chef, a great home cook chef. And there was homemade wine. It was somebody in West Philly made a wine called Moroni wine, came in a big green jug. And then there was like the stuff that they drank after dinner, and it was that esoteric collection of like CNR, all those weird kind of Italian Amaro.
Yeah.
So I grew up, and then I grew up eating stuff like dandelion greens and arugula and chicory and those sauteed bitter things. So that was never strange to me. But then when I met my like suburban white friends that were eating whatever they were eating, it was like, no way. Like, that wasn't part of the American palate.
Wasn't touched.
So what drew you into bitters?
Well, I had a similar upbringing to you in a way, except instead of West Philly, it was the foothills of Santa Barbara, California. There's a similarity there. But
no.
But, you know, we made wine. We would go berry hunting, and we made wines out of every kind of berry you could imagine. I mean, like berries people don't know out here, like lolliberries, cool things like that. Not into Amari. We didn't have the Italian heritage. It was more of a mixed Jewish, weird, Northeastern, Protestant combo type thing.
That's a mashup.
Yeah, we had the mashup.
Ashkenazi Jew meets wasp.
We had that. But yeah, and then, you know, we grew our own food the same way. We had a nice garden in the back. And so I just grew up with kind of the palate of fresh vegetables and kind of ranging home cooking. And that kept me, you know, I think open-minded from day one. And so I did have one cool thing I like to kid around about, was that I'm old enough too that back in the day when I come visit New York City where my family's from, I could pass for 21 when I was 14, 15.
Did a mustache or something?
Yeah, and I just kind of being with my dad, who has kind of a swagger, is the old New York dude, and he knows his way around town. And so we'd hit bars. And, and I, you know, again, I wasn't abusing alcohol, but my dad would indulge me like you.
Part of social life, man.
Part of social life. And I'd drink a martini up at like Gino's up on like 63rd and Lex. And I just always had that love of the cocktail from very early on.
Let's bore down on the bitters thing, because it's really, that's, again, the book's Bitters and Amari. So you define it. You have it in the book, and I don't want to read it verbatim. So bitters are what? These sort of extractions? You define it.
Yeah, the sexy definition is an alcohol-based flavor extract with a bitter foundation at the flavor. So there's two things. There's bitters, and there's Amaro.
Two different things. Right. Bitters tend to be these tinctures. You're adding them in small droplets or shakes, and we can get into that, because there's that whole, what is, right? Yeah. I mean, so anyway. So they're added to cocktails as part of a flavor profile for steering them. And these Amari, which is the plural of Amaro, are these kind of generally consumed, in my mind, after dinner, as sort of almost digestives. You can have them before dinner, too.
Yep.
They're just these kind of, I don't know, you describe Amari, because you wrote the book.
Yeah, well, and that's, you know, the beauty of it is it's a really simple definition, and it's not what people might think. There isn't, you can't, a analysis of the liquid itself isn't going to give you the answer. Really, the ultimate definition is what shape of bottle is it in. If it's a small bottle for dropping or dashing, it's a bitters. If it's a big bottle for gulping or sipping or mixing, it's an Amaro. I don't even look farther than that. And really, there's actually kind of a continuum, because there are bitters that are probably sweeter and weaker than Amari. So they're like a really, really sturdy Fernet, for example, which is a type of Amaro.
Right.
Those things can be muscular and burly and super, super dense. And a couple drops of those in a cocktail is going to totally transform it. And then there are bitters, frankly, maybe on the not so good variety, that are quite weak and thin and light and delicate, and you'd have to use a couple teaspoons or even a shot of it to get a result. So it's a whole continuum
that blends and crosses over, and if you put these circles on each other, they overlap like crazy. Yep. And it's funny, because I talk to my winemaker friends, and Alice Firing is a great friend, and I've been reading Elizabeth Legeron's book on natural wine, and you know, we think about like the history of man, and we've been distilling stuff for, you know, 8,000 years B.C. Yeah. Yeah. We don't have a lot of written records. We don't have a lot of pieces of evidence, because that stuff's been destroyed. But we know historically, and bitters go back just that far.
That's a cool point. So the oldest alcoholic beverage ever discovered on the face of the earth, they found some pottery shards, I forget where, somewhere in Central Europe. They did an analysis on these things, and there was some grape wine. It was a grape and barley wine residue with hawthorn berries in it. Hawthorn berries, a bitter medicine. And because it's bitter and medicinal, there was also honey in this residue. Right. So you know that. You found that research.
Yep.
And so the first alcoholic beverage ever discovered on the face of the earth was an Amaro.
It's crazy, right?
It's an old tradition, and it's continued nonstop for the last 7,000 or 8,000 years.
And then you throw in the ability to distill. So yeah. This alembic comes in, and we don't know exactly when or where. We think it was the Middle East somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think I'm 99.9% sure that initially it was used for extraction of flowers and herbs,
yep.
perfumes,
yep.
for health benefits. And then it got in somebody's hands. I mean, again, the story has it, because this is all lore, that as the Moors came to Europe through Spain, that the Europeans got their hands on these things and said, well,
rather drink it than
die. What if I put wine in one end of this thing and this shit comes out that's 100 proof on the other end? We're on to something. And that's kind of where we began to distill alcohol.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair assessment, and I think it started most likely for floral about 2000 BC or so. I think that's when it came about. So distillation has a kind of a cool history, because it served its master. Like who wanted what from it? I think
correct, because you could make medicines from it. Mm-hmm. You could get extracts and medicines, and it's still how perfumes made, good perfumes made, which is astonishing, because you're sort of isolating these esters that are volatile in concentrations that make them superb.
Yep.
And wouldn't exist in nature in that density. And then we're you know, thank the whole booze world for distillation.
Yeah, well, then you put your finger on it. I mean, that's the beauty of any of the, like, the medicinal background, the herbalist tradition is, it's a way of concentrating whatever kind of volatile properties in a plant in a stable base like alcohol, and you can keep it around 24/7, 365 days a year. Because if you were relying on a medicine, it was only in bloom for a month a year.
You're right. What do you do the other 10 months? Correct.
Yeah,
right.
So they'd fix it. So yeah, I think the distilling tradition is pretty cool, and how it's also evolved to serve Amari in new ways. It's actually not finished. Like in the last 60, 70 years, for example, they finally figured out how to distill gentian root. And they make an actual distillate, like Avez and Suze, distilled gentian root. So gentian root, which is...
That's the flavor of Suze. That's funny.
Yeah.
I had a French chef that loved it, and he... I don't think you... Can you get it here in the States now?
You can now.
You couldn't before, and every time I used to go to France, as a gift for Christian Louvre, great guy. Christian, if you're listening, I love you, man. One of my mentors. I would bring him home a couple of bottles of Suze, which is this like weird-tasting French concoction. I don't know what it was, but he grew up eating it. He would like love that stuff. Made him so happy.
Yeah.
So gentian root, that's what the flavor is.
Yeah, and so gentian's it's really widely used in Amaros and bitter. Amari and bitters.
Okay.
There's many different kinds. The most famous in Western Europe is probably the yellow gentian from France, the south of France, and it's used in Italian Amari and in Spanish and in Switzerland and in Croatia. It's used everywhere, but it's also used in French liqueurs, of course. And its most common and well known use is in a type of drink that's a relative of vermouth called the gentian. So vermouth is a fortified wine,
right,
with botanicals extracted in it, with bitterness in it that comes from wormwood. Vermouth comes from the German word Vermut,
yep,
or wormwood. So a gentian, just like a vermouth, except it used gentian root instead of Amaro.
Have you met Bianca Moravia from Uncouth?
No.
Have you heard of her?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's cool. We had her on the radio a while back, and we filmed with her a couple of weeks ago. She's doing this. I mean, she's like bored. She's making this like really small batch artisanal vermouth in Red Hook, Brooklyn.
Oh man.
And no caramel coloring, like straight up. Like,
yeah.
And she's growing her own herbs and botanicals upstate New York organically. Like, she's hardcore.
That's one of those things most people don't know, is that red vermouth, sweet vermouth. It's from white wine.
Right.
That lovely color.
And I feel terrible. You know? I'm doing these two interviews today, and like my drink for, like, I don't feel terrible, fuck it. But my go-to drink for like forever has been the Negroni, like before it was popular. I've been drinking Negronis for 30 years because I always loved Campari and I love gin. And and I use now that there's better vermouths like Carpano, but still Carpano is full of caramel coloring.
It's,
I know. I realize that. And Campari is fucking commodity shit. And I guess the gin's good. I don't know.
But you can do like Dolin Blanc now. You know,
it's
that's
true.
And that actually makes it beautiful, different, and very light.
Totally changes the profile. Yep. There's a restaurant up here called Lincoln, Jonathan Benno's restaurant in Lincoln Center. That's a great restaurant. They've got a whole section. They've got like a whole Negroni program that offers you a million substitutes, like you just said. So going to a white vermouth, going to instead of Campari, something that has that orange flavor in it but doesn't have the old bullshit coloring and isn't factory, whatever.
There's a recipe in my book that's the embittered Negroni, and I pull back on the Campari and the vermouth and just throw bitters in there to fill in the gap, and it tastes delicious. It's more focused. And
so talk about like the making of bitters at home.
Yeah.
This is really interesting. So again, the name of the book's Bitters and Amari, A Field Guide to Bitters and Amari by Mark Bitterman.
What are like the basics that people need to make these things at home? Because it's way simpler than you think.
It's simpler than you think, and you get better results than you'd think you'd get just doing it yourself. There's a very low barrier to entry in this sort of thing. You can buy a list of just fantastic, high quality botanicals at two or three or four sites online. You get yourself a couple bittering agents. We talked about a few before, like gentian root and wormwood, but it could be quassia, it could be devil's club. There's a ton of them. Cinchona bark, which is the same bittering agent that's used in quinine and in tonic. Just buy a bunch of these, and then you get a hold
of.
You
can get these online.
Though. Yeah, it's easy peasy.
What a funny world, huh?
It's so weird. It takes you about 15 minutes to put together a couple batches.
And then before that, what's it, Q-Tonic, before the British company did that really good tonic water the right way, I mean, we were growing up, it was totally acceptable in a great restaurant or bar to drink Schweppes. Your gin and tonic was whatever the hell the gin was. And the shit that's made from just junk with high fructose corn syrup.
Yep. Synthetic quinine.
Right.
Yeah.
And I remember when Q-Tonic, it was another Fever Tree. That came out with, and they actually did the research and went to South or whatever it took, but it was like, man, now you can actually get that stuff online. It's that easy.
And you can also buy really high quality tonic syrups. So it's just it's the tonic concentrate.
Now
the whole mess of people are making those around the country now, and then you just add some seltzer water and you're off to the races.
And when did your company start?
Back in 2006.
So I don't know if you heard the previous interview, but so I got to New York in 82 and worked in restaurant business all through that time frame. And somewhere in the early part of this century, this millennium, there began to be, and guys like Dale DeGroff were always there, but they were kind of like outliers, and they had to play to the public. I mean, Dale had to make whatever people were asking for dry martinis. Yeah. It's a dry martini, sir. I could just shake it or whatever. But then suddenly there was this emergence of this cocktail culture, this really studiously serious.
Yeah.
Mixologists became a term that one bantered about, and you would go to places like PDT and Death and Company and wherever. There was a bunch of them all around
Clyde
New York.
Clyde Commons out in Portland, Oregon.
I know New York City's. And, you know, you had these guys that were really serious behind the bar, using these really dead-on, like, sourcing really good American spirits or really good gins or really good whatever, and tinctures and an ice program that was very specific, you know, what? Yeah. Like, no one's using cedar ice anymore? No. We hand-carve our cubes. And that bitter thing was like, in lockstep with that.
Yeah.
Because suddenly that whole ingredient thing opened up. Go back historically in America. Talk to me about, like, Peychaud's, the early America. So we're in the early 1800s, 1825, in that time frame.
Sure. So, you know, I mean, the cocktail general, some of the scholarship now on cocktails pins the date of the earliest cocktails in the late 1700s.
Wow.
Kind of incredible. And I guess the first use, and that was the julep, came about way back then. And it was made with rum. So then in the early 1800s, cocktail came about. It was defined as a drink that was made with bitters, water, alcohol, and sugar. It was a cocktail. And when that was happening, the bitters at the time were effectively patent medicines. They were amari. It was the same thing. There was no difference between a bitters and an amaro. Actually, the word amaro just means bitters in English.
Right.
So there was no difference. It was just an English amaro. But these intense, medicinal, terrible-tasting things. No one knows really if the alcohol and sugar was added to the bitters to make it taste better or if the bitters were added to the alcohol and sugar to create some new creation. No one really knows. But at any rate, that whole invention spurred sort of a culture of innovation, and more drinks started to come out in different ways and styles. And it wasn't until the mid to late 1800s you started to have actual celebrity bartenders, like pros, badasses, people who could make a ton of things, who knew the history,
New Orleans and New York and Chicago.
Yeah,
I mean, New Orleans was front and center early on with all this stuff.
New Orleans front and center, even Washington, Virginia, there was just a lot of stuff going around there. So that movement went in lockstep with a proliferation of bitters, but the proliferation—that's a hard word to say.
Proliferation. You say it.
bitters. What was not really entirely synced up, to best of my knowledge, with cocktails. It was actually still this gigantic, thriving patent medicine world. So back in 1906, there was a Safe Food Standards Act, or the Safe Food Act was passed, and suddenly you had to be bona fide. You couldn't just put, quote, snake oil, unquote, into your stuff, or you couldn't put formaldehyde or whatever else you felt like it in there, and you couldn't make claims like it cures everything. So it put most of these people out of business. And suddenly you only had legitimate products around, but it culled quite a few from the American kind of Wild West of bitters. And then what happened, of course, is Prohibition after that. And that killed off just about
everything.
Everyone else.
Yeah, that was the dark. I mean, that was a.
Yep.
So that was for the restaurant business, for the wine growing in America, for viticulture, for everything. That was like the beginning of the day. It was a prohibition, and then it was the Great Depression, which was horrible. Then it was the entrance into World War II. I mean, it was just like 50-year black hole that we went in the culinary world, spirits world, and wine world.
Yeah, and we wouldn't have had the Great Depression if we had not had prohibition. I'm convinced of it. Who would have bothered? These bitters like Amaro, like Angostura
and Peychaud's, right.
They were around through this whole scene, and they became a part of the mixology culture and part of the canon of drink making, but they weren't the only ones by a long shot, and there were other really, really popular ones. Two of the most ones that come to mind first and right off the top are like Boker's bitters, really, really widely used, very versatile bitters, and Abbott's bitters was the actual bitters used to make Manhattans. Mm. So I hope my friends over at Angostura aren't listening, but Angostura is actually not the ideal aromatic bitters. It's the one that survived. It's really kind of a funny thing.
That's history.
So bartenders all around the world all using Angostura bitters, and that's just almost like shorthand for bitters. The weird thing is if you taste an Angostura, like we do tastings all the time, and we taste people through 5 or 6 or 8 or 15 bitters, you get to Angostura and you're like, wow, well, this just tastes like pumpkin pie meets apple pie meets potpourri. And again, that's good. Those are good things. But is that what I want in my beautiful, lean rye Manhattan with a fantastic vermouth? Actually, it's not. It almost never is. You go to a Boker's Bitters, and now you've got this bright, vibrant, almost minerally flavor. The thing just like punches, and the tannins and recede in the rye, and this vanillins come forward, and there's this roughness to it that actually becomes balanced, and it's a fantastic drink without the potpourri. So that's one of the things I like about bitters is I think it's one of the reasons why bitters are part of this resurgence in craft cocktails is they're a way to look back to a truer representation of the drink, a better celebration of the booze. It's all there in the bitters. And of course, there's all this cockamamie crazy stuff that people are putting together out of thin air. And so there's ways to innovate and create new flavor profiles. I mean, what is it? Avery, the guy who stole my last name for Bitterman's Bitters. I don't know what his deal is, but he did a Mole Bitters, and suddenly there's chocolate in cocktails that they're really, really not a history of that.
Right.
And frankly, it's indispensable. It's great. It's a great ingredient.
And don't you have something here with smoke?
Yeah, smoke.
Which sounded really interesting. It's one of the things that like when I first had.
Oh yeah.
When I first sort of morphed from really good agave-based tequilas and to really good mezcal, mm-hmm. I was like, "Whoa, smoke!" Just this hint in the background.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, you talk about it in the book that smoke. We can't hold it. We smell it and we taste it in smoked foods, but it's such a hard thing to capture.
Yeah.
And yet you've got this great recipe for adding like was it oak ash or oak?
Yeah. So there's I actually got a couple. One of them is. Toasting oak chips, and that gives you it's a barrel bitters, and it does not taste like a barrel aged bitters. I actually am not interested in that, but it tastes like this fantastic woodsy, bold, rich flavor, and it plays wonderfully in brown liquors. And then I also have some bitters that use a little dash of Lapsang Souchong, and that gives
Which
you a beautiful
smoke.
Smokiness.
Right? Yeah. That's fascinating.
Speaking of Negronis, though, my favorite non-bitters improvement to or twist on a Negroni is to mezcal it. Mezcal instead of gin. Are you giving that a shot?
Holy shit.
Oh, go home.
My liver's like, dude, just why are you doing
this? Let's go do this.
So what are the basics that someone needs? I mean, you have this great book out, and it's photographed beautifully. What are the basics that people need tool-wise to start making bitters at home?
It's as simple as it could possibly be.
So we talked about some of the ingredients you can get over the internet, but what else? Alcohols, glycerin, what else are we looking at?
So you get some alcohol, and that's usually just anything overproof. It's the ethanol that is what is extracting the aromatics and the flavor compounds of these botanicals. So you the higher the proof, the more the extraction. I used to use – in Oregon, we can get the really, really overproof, whatever it is, 190-something Everclear. I actually prefer –
There's a name for that.
Yeah, there is.
Everclear.
But I think like the 160 proof range is a fantastic place to get your booze, and it gives you a really beautiful extraction. There's just enough alcohol, just enough water in there to give you some of the water extraction too, because some molecules are water soluble.
Correct.
So you get that, and then so your alcohol and your bitter, the alcohol you pick will be based on the bitters you want to make. So you could use a shorthand and even use a gin. So you've got already kind of a complex base.
Right, with the botanicals that are present in it already.
You got it. Or you could use an overproof rye or bourbon or you name it. It's easy to do. And then the other ingredients you need is a mason jar and some cheesecloth. And
for straining at the end.
For straining at the end. That's kind of more or less it.
So this is really like DIY.
Yeah, dropper bottles. You can buy those online too for a buck
each. Because you have a good section of the book, which is really neat. Because, you know, when you're getting these exact recipes and you read a recipe that says, you know, it's pretty precise on the alcohol, an ounce of this, an ounce of that, so much of lemon juice of heaven. And then there'll be a shake of something.
Yeah.
And then you bore down on like, which kind of makes sense as like a chef and someone with even half a brain that, all jars aren't shaped the same. All of those little plastic tubing things are the same. Talk about the variation in that. I mean, I talked about I've got a lot of baking friends, and we talk about like I hate recipes where the ingredients aren't weighed out. They're done by measure because a cup of flour. So you have flour sitting at home that's been pounded down, that's been sitting on the store, that's been the pallet got slammed, the box got slammed, it hit a shelf, it fell on your car floor, and now it's sitting. And so the variations between a cup of that versus a cup of fluffy flour is like ounces, and it completely steers the recipe the wrong way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're not going by weight, you're just shooting in the dark.
Yep.
And same thing with the idea of a dash.
Yeah.
So talk about how you – what the variations in what a dash is and a way to correct that at home.
Yeah, I actually did a dropper to dash conversion.
And it was crazy.
And the hardest part is that bottles have different size restrictors. So the restrictor is a little plastic cap on the top of it.
The thing on the top, that white thing.
The little white thing. And they're different. There are folks like the Dale DeGroff Pimento Bitters has a restrictor that you could drive a Subway through. It's just this huge bottle. So he's a smart man. He wants you to use a lot of his bitters. So you do a dash and it's like it fills your glass up. You're like, well, that was enough bitters. And then you take something like an Angostura or a Regan's and it's just a little bit that comes out at a time. And frankly, the other weird part, there's actually a parabola. When you have a little bit of liquor, liquid in the bottle, a little bit comes out. And then as more and more and more comes
air,
out,
right, the more air you bitter. Have in.
Yeah.
Right.
And then for some fluke of physics that I won't get into, when there's almost none left, very little comes out again. Basically, the reason why is because there's not enough energy behind the the liquid to come flowing back out. So you have this parabola of a little bit.
At the beginning of the bottle, you're getting nothing. Middle of the bottle, you're getting twice as much as you thought. End of the bottle, you're getting nothing again.
Yeah. So if you're using a dash, in my first cookbook, Salted, I actually refuse to use tablespoons as my salt measure. It's like just baloney. Salt is this living, breathing material. Every single salt's different. You're a cook. You need to know your ingredient. You have to use your fingers. So I just insisted on that. And with the bitters book, I wrestled over and over and over again.
Salt because the surface area is a different shape of the crystals.
Yep, different,
right, like
different
if you
weights.
If you picture like that, what's that stuff? The one with the woman with the umbrella that one uses.
Whatever, we won't name that one.
Right, whatever, with the one with iodine in it. Like that stuff is like lethal. Like you pour that into a teaspoon and it's like a gazillion versus kosher salt, which is kind of what most chefs used to because I remember early on when people say, why do you use kosher salt? I'm like, because I could feel it.
Yeah.
I said, if you look closely, if you sprinkle it down, it looks like snowflakes.
Yeah.
It covers, it's crunchy, and then we'll get in the world of sea salt. But there's like a total difference. Like that other stuff, that like popcorn, it's like the worst. It's like so salt dense and gross.
It's salt dense
and I
gross.
Love salt.
Yeah. I think that's what it says on the side of the box.
Salt dense and gross plus iodine.
Yeah.
Which you don't need because no one's getting.
You don't need it.
That
you get it elsewhere.
Gout or whatever. Not gout. What was it?
Goiter.
Goiter. Thank you. Thank you. And you even have, it's an amazing book on how to make bitters at home, which is kind of, again, for all you DIY types, and I give the hats off to the whole millennial generation because they've really run with this ball. And I think so much of the food culture today that's so vibrant and the alcohol culture, wine culture, is because you young kids are just so smart. You've embraced this thing. Americans have so much spirit and energy that you've just taken it like way past where anybody else has. And it keeps going this way. But you're also incorporating like, you have like a cioppino recipe there with like a citrusy, not a citrusy, like an anisey flavor.
Yeah.
So you're incorporating it. So we're getting out of the alcohol realm and saying, you know, how about if we do a salad dressing that incorporates bitters? How about if we do this cioppino that incorporates like what? So talk about that because that's kind of funny. That's really almost getting out of your purview.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the one of the main reasons why I even believe in making your own bitters at home is because I don't think you should use bitters a little bit at a time once in a while. I think bitters should be part of your life. And we're all busy as heck, but we all love flavor. We love stuff that's dense and intense and bold. So bitters let you to add flavor in by the dose. So if you're using bitters a lot, making it at home, it's easier than preserving. It's easier than pickling. It's easier than anything else. And now you've got this beautiful, powerful, complex additive that you can use in drinks and in cooking. So to me, a salad dressing, we all know we love bitter in a salad already. That's why we use arugula and
radicchio
and endive and all that
right.
good stuff.
And acid from the vinegar, which is on the bitter side
yep.
of bitter.
Right. It's fantastic. And even zests and all right. that. So it's fantastic to have in there. So a bitters in a dressing just accentuates that. So what I'll do is I'll just make any old dressing, could you know, whatever, a shallot vinaigrette. And I'll do a mess of grapefruit bitters in there or lemon bitters in there. The whole thing comes alive.
Right, it's a citric component, yep. these high-end tones you're getting.
Caesar salad. You know, and one of the things I'll mention, by the way, is that you know if you haven't paid attention to lettuce lately, it is not the same as it was 10 or 20 years ago. They bred all the bitterness out of it. So you're buying – romaine used to be this dense – like if you look at old school romaine, it's these dense little curly little leaves that are dark green and bitter and delicious. So much flavor. That's gone.
And that's like watery stalks.
Yeah. So yeah, watery stalks.
With some
like,
green things around.
It's weird. You just juice it and be done with it. And that's like a horror to me. But you can use some bitters in your dressing with a Caesar salad. It's fantastic. So I use it in all my dressings. And same thing with a sauce. If I'm deglazing a pan, I'll throw a little sherry, a little bit of brandy, a little bit of tequila in there, a little bit of wine, and a dash or two of bitters. And it just kicks it that way. I mean, I am a salt person, so I'm always thinking about that already. But this is another little tool, right. another little trick right. up your sleeve.
And I love the Cioppino idea. So we have this yeah. sort of West Coast seafood stew that's in every culture that has a coastline makes some variation. I mean, yep. I don't care if you're Korea, Japan, Southern Italy. Everyone's making something where they're steaming open clam shells and mussel shells using that broth. And then throw a couple of scallops in there. We have the shrimp laying around. We have a little bit of this. Yep. And, you know, yep. blah, blah, blah. And then you're adding this one, like, was it a fennel component?
Fennel bitters.
Which makes sense because, like, in bouillabaisse in the old days, I remember the French were constantly adding, they would finish it with Pernod,
yeah, right,
or
exactly.
Absinthe, or one of those, yeah. or actually have shaved fresh fennel as part of the broth.
Both of which are such a strong move.
Yeah, so smart.
Yeah, so this is just shorthand for that.
Dude, it's a great book. I never thought I would be inspired to make homemade bitters, but I'm thinking I'm going to start doing this stuff because, I mean, come on, why not? Like, you're supposed to be a chef. Walk the walk, dude.
Walk the walk. And and I'll mention again, it's easier than people think. It also takes less time than you think.
Yeah, just in terms of assembling, and then just a matter of time for the maceration, wait.
Yep.
X amount of days, weeks, months, and strain, and you're done. You're good to go.
And one of the things I found in my exploration with the book is the internet. On the internet, you find these recipes that say let it sit for 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, blah blah blah. I find that I'm getting tremendous flavor in days.
Period.
Or days and several days, maybe a week for certain things. You get all the high notes, all the bright strident flavors come out right away, and then all that time after that, you're just getting these tannins and alkaloids. And stuff that it's bitter and dense, which is kind of cool, but it's the flatter flavors.
Right.
So I use bright, shiny bittering agents like gentian root and cinchona bark to give me bold, fresh, like sharp bitterness. And then I also keep my bitter, my aromatic ingredients in there for a short time, so they're also bright. You get a much brighter, kind of high profile, high fidelity bitters.
Love it, man. Sounds like cooking. Sounds just like when we make socks and soups, and yep. when it's perfect, it's perfect. Cooking another 2 hours won't make any. You're just gonna,
yep.
you know.
We're talking about that last night with a friend of mine. We were just like, well, how you know people? You don't. Your stock does not need to be on the pot for 4 days. It
yeah,
does
it's
not
true.
Help it.
It's true. That's correct. I mean, unless you got the honking big ass cow hips and big bones, and even yeah. then, you're probably 12 hours and you're done.
Yeah.
All right. Great book. The Field Guide to Bitters and Amari. Mark Bitterman appropriately named, wrote the book. It's super. It really is. I mean, if you wanted to get yourself something like a gift for – if you're a DIY inclined person, this is a great book to have. Everyone's in the cocktail world. Everyone's into the spirits world. You need this book. Who's the publisher?
Andrews McMeel.
Available at Amazon and any store near you, I'm assuming.
Yeah, that's right.
Got you. Thanks for coming in. That's it for Food Talk. We got a great show coming up next week. Stay tuned for that. Be well. Eat well often. See you in a week.
For listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. The one and only Dave Arnold brings the noise to Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday on Cooking Issues.
Coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn!
If the bomb was going to drop, and you only had 15 minutes, which is like, I can make a sandwich in 15 minutes, and you'd be eating a sandwich.
I'd kiss my wife, make a sandwich.
If you believe that it's all about to be over, why eat healthy? Not a freaking Neanderthal. I like a tempered ice cream sandwich. But it's the only way to get around it if you're a party master, because you're going to wind up, like, your kitchen's going to fill with dishes. And
some people have commercial dishwashers in their house.
Who?
I've seen them.
Who?
I've seen them.
Who?
Really rich people.
For more mile-a-minute knowledge from Dave and the crew, listen to Cooking Issues, available on Heritage Radio Network, iTunes, and Stitcher.